Hi, I'm Zoe Clark, and welcome back to Without Borders. Today, we've got three guests for the price of one, the first being Sarah Spencer, the director of Notflix, which is the improvised musical comedy that turns audience-suggested films into instant musicals. Sarah's joined by Holly Mallett and Ailish Duff, two other members of her Notflix team.
Hi, and I'm Brendan Craigie, and we're going to be hearing on this episode about the importance of saying yes and rather than yes but if you want to foster an environment of creativity and innovation. We're going to be hearing about how we should all, you know, see improv as being a way of life. And finally, we're going to hear about how Notflix became a sellout show at the Edinburgh Fringe and how having a conviction and an unflinching belief in your idea was so important to making that happen.
True, actually, at the Fringe, I never used to see stand up at all.
Did you know?
I'd only ever go to like sort of theatre stuff. And then this year, I suddenly
realised. You're lucky if we see a single play.
One of my friends was like, "Oh, what good plays would you recommend from Edinburgh this year?" And I looked back and was like, "I only saw stand up or improv."
Yeah, I can tell you some pretty epic queer cabaret feminist. Yeah. Strip teases, but I'm not sure I can
do
it.
No theatre.
God.
Yeah, like, oh God, what's happened to me? I blame you guys.
I blame us. Yeah.
I blame Sarah Spencer.
Definitely.
If in doubt.
Don't worry, I'll sack him. Don't worry.
Everything seems to lead back to you,
Sarah.
Do you think?
Yeah.
We need to uncover more.
We do normally only have the one guest, so we are honoured to have 300% more than our normal quota of people in the studio with Brendan and I. So I think probably the best place to start would be just a very, very quick introduction from each of you so we know who you are. And seeing as we're going to be talking a little bit about musicals and what have you today, maybe you can delight us with what is your favourite and why?
Oh, favourite musical theatre. Well, my name's Sarah and I'm the director of Notflix, the improvised musical, and also the director of Notflix corporate training. So kind of two strands. Favourite musical? Do you know, I'm a Chorus Line girl. Love Chorus Line. The much maligned one act 1970s classic. Chorus Line, love it. Perfect. Absolutely fabulous songs and camp as you like, which I think sums up us.
Excellent. I'm Ailish Duff. I'm one of the performers in Notflix, and I'm also an actor. My favourite musical, there's so many to choose from. I think I'm going to have to go with, because it's fresh in my mind, because I recently saw a production of it, Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, I love that.
It's so good. I just love it. It was the first musical I was ever in when I was a teenager, and I've just been in love with it ever since. Super camp, super creepy. I love it.
And I'm Holly. I'm an actor muso, and I pretend to be a writer, and I'm 1/6 of Notflix also. My favourite musicals growing up were Wicked and Rent, anything to do with Idina Menzel. But my current favourite, because I see a lot, is Sylvia at the Old Vic, about Sylvia Pankhurst. And it's like, it's a bit like Hamilton, but all about women.
Right.
And it's a work in progress. So I'm like loving the feminist vibe.
Yeah.
Took my mum to see it. She literally stood up during one of the songs. It was
brilliant.
Top tip there.
Right.
Top tip there, Sylvia. Closes this month.
And bring Holly's mum if you want a standing ovation.
My mum's great crack.
Yeah, excellent.
Excellent. So Notflix then. So tell us a little bit more about this. You're hot off the back of a really successful Edinburgh Fringe session, whatever the right word would be. Tell us a bit more.
So Notflix has been going about 3 years now. We are still currently the only all-female improvised musical comedy, certainly in the UK. I'd imagine probably in the US as well. There's no challenges to my claim that we are anyway. And so what we do is we take a movie that you've recently seen and we turn it into a full musical of 1 hour in length. All the songs are entirely made up. We have a full live band with a sax and drums and keyboard. Everything you hear on stage from the second we take the suggestion is entirely made up. And if we're doing a good job, which we generally are, you will be convinced that we wrote it, we prepared it. And that's what we do.
It's utterly amazing. From someone who, to be honest, is a bit of a planner in life, not particularly good at improvising anything, it blows my mind a little bit that you do all of this from scratch. We were watching a little bit of it earlier online. And you would never believe that you'd made all that up on the spot. It's phenomenal.
And do you think we all have that sort of capability in us to sort of to be funny and to improvise? Or
I think all of us have that capability, but we censor ourselves. And I think we're just very lucky that our business is to free ourselves.
Yes.
And I mean, we all play as children, and we certainly have no problems being creative when we're in the playground, and we live in an imaginary world where everything is possible. There's no such thing as no. We say yes constantly. Yes, and I'll be a princess and you'll be a dragon and things just build. But the older we get, the more scared we get. And it's that censorship that creeps in from the second we're teenagers, and suddenly all the factors that make us grown-ups stop our improvisational mindset. And actually, certainly within the training that we do, that's what we aim to free, your inner improviser, because actually the knock-on effects, being able to listen, saying yes is such a liberating thing. Just for one day, be confident enough to say, yeah, do you know what, we can. So everybody's got it, but it's whether you are confident enough to free it.
Yeah.
Also, whenever somebody says to me, I don't think I could do improv, I'm like, wow, I did not get the script of this conversation we're having right now.
Yeah.
Because every day is improv. You can plan as much as you want, but you can't stop that person who also can't plan something, knocking a coffee into you or getting something from left field. Or
you're with a customer, or you're in a meeting, and the script that you had in your head goes a different way. Well, obviously you improvise because you're bouncing off of a human connection. Mm. It's in us.
Yeah.
Not everyone necessarily wants to get on stage and improvise songs and raps. But then I think we're a bit silly, maybe.
I think there is this sort of tension, isn't there, that when you go into the world of business, you have an expectation of how you you should behave and how you should conform, and you know, what does professional look like and what does success look like? And yet, on the flip side, what the world's sort of crying out for is individuals, people who are creative, coming at things with different ideas. And, you know, and we expect that of people as well, but we don't sort of create the environment for them to be those individuals and those creative, you know, people. We actually sort of create an environment which sort of forces them to, or encourages them to conform, you know? And I think it's really interesting.
Mm. I mean, look at Google. look at Google, Netflix. I realise that's quite creative. On YouTube, they have like gig rooms where you just like hang out and play music and then carry on with your day.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's what business should be, right?
Yeah. Well, innovation.
Yeah.
Yeah. We genuinely, from the second we set foot on the stage, nothing's planned. Nothing. And we just have to lean into that. And actually, the biggest learning curve we've been on, I think, with the show is lean into the mistakes. Because when nothing is prescribed, a mistake is not a mistake. A mistake is a platform to a better idea.
Yes.
And I think that idea is translatable into any situation.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to say it. Say it, because a contribution is a platform to jump off of.
Yeah, sort of owning your own failures and realising that actually failure is just a step. Whereas if you'd never said that at all, that hasn't inspired the rest of the group. Whereas actually by putting yourself out there and not sort of censoring it and going, oh, what will people think about me and what will people say? If you just sort of go for it, then even if that idea doesn't get used, even if it's not the best idea in the world, it's going to help the fact that you've actually said it.
Yeah,
great. And certainly when we improvise, and again, I think this is a transferable skill, we listen until the end of the sentence.
Yeah.
We don't listen in an inactive way. It's about listening to every single word that the person on stage says, because it might be the final word in that sentence is where the gold is. If you're listening with an intent to say something funny, that's when we have our worst shows. Actually, being an active listener is the secret to so much of what we do, being successful on stage.
And when you encounter sort of ordinary, boring people like us, no, I'm joking.
Speak for yourself.
What do you find like is the biggest sort of inhibitor, or you know, how do you get people to loosen up, and how do you sort of get people to sort of buy into the improvisation?
It's about playing.
Yeah.
Genuinely stepping off that edge and not being afraid to do something a little bit out the box.
Yeah.
So when we teach corporate workshops, we start with things that are going to sound terrifying, but we might make you rap, for example. We might teach you how to put together, she's cringing, we put together a basic structure, how to put together a couplet, and then we move around in a circle and we get you over that fear straight away. Because actually that inaction is exactly what we're saying. There's no such thing as a wrong thing. The only thing you can do wrong is not contribute.
Yeah.
And by starting with something big like that, nothing we're going to ask you to do in a workshop session is going to be as hard as that. And then we relate those, I guess, those lessons that we've learned from being performers on stage.
Yeah.
Once our show starts, we don't confer, we don't stop.
Yeah.
So there are other improvised musical shows which are all fantastic, but there is thinking time for the actors.
Yeah.
We have none for an hour. So if something goes wrong, we lean in.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest lesson that we can teach somebody wanting to learn to improvise, actually. The mistake could be where the gold is.
Absolutely. Mm. Some of our funniest, most poignant moments, actually. Mostly funniest, but some of our most poignant moments and most interesting storylines have come from somebody mishearing something or making a mistake, and then we lean into it. There are just so many times where somebody said something and you're like, this is what this version of Dunkirk is,
or
this version of Austin Powers is. And that's why we can do, last year we did 3 different Dunkirks in a month because it was the big movie of the of the year. And actually we could have done more if we hadn't have said this isn't fair on returning audiences. But each of them was completely different.
Yeah.
And one of them was literally because somebody misheard something.
So a technical point here, how can you do the same one 3 times? Because surely by nature you're going to remember what you've done before and it's not improv?
I guess because one of the things we really do is we listen to the suggestion from the audience member. So those 3 Dunkirks we did were suggested by 3 separate people. So the synopsis they wrote was totally different.
Okay.
So like I think we had one of them where it was just like, Tom Hardy is a pilot or something. So we did this whole thing about just Tom Hardy learning to be a pilot. And that ended up being one of the central. And then we had this other one of the other Dunkirks where, because we take 2 suggestions and then the audience vote on which one they want. And the rival going up against Dunkirk that day was Life of Pi.
Right.
So and it was a really close call, but we ended up getting Dunkirk. But where we then put, you know, one of the scenes was about the people in the rescue boats and there was just a tiger in one of the boats. We were like, there we go.
It's releasing your inner tiger. So we did an Eye of the Tiger parody. And then another one was a perfect example of somebody misspeaking. It was a kid and his dad on a boat. And then the person playing the dad accidentally spoke about when the dad had died. And we were like,
two dads.
So I think I walked on and just went, is this the Lesbians and Gay Support the War Mission effort? And it became this big story.
Dunkirk meets Pride. It was great.
Yeah, where it turned out the dad hadn't died. He had just gone off to be a major and they were all reunited and everybody came out. So.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of the way we pitch our show. We're not replicating that movie. So if you want to see... if you want to see Jaws, go and see Jaws. We are going to create you the musical version because everything is better as a musical. So what would Jaws be like if it were a musical? Well, it would be 100% more camp. Probably there'll be different storylines that we'd follow. And we have, as Ailish said, that suggestion from the audience is the jumping off point. So if you've described it wrong, like one year we had Titanic, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
And they said, didn't watch till the end. I think it was happy. So that's how our Titanic ended.
Yeah.
As long as you've got that, every show's going to be different.
Yeah.
And so have you always got a kick? Have you always gotten a kick out of making people laugh? Or, you know, is that something that's been part of your life?
I don't know. I've certainly always enjoyed comedy and, making people laugh. I never really thought of myself as a funny person until this, really. I sort of just assumed it was something I wasn't very good at and I enjoyed, but it was something for other people to do.
So how did you get into it then? Did somebody say, you know, you should really do this, you are quite funny? Or did you suddenly have a realisation one day? Or?
I don't know. I think I auditioned for this just because it sounded really fun and hilarious and then sort of just... ended up sort of, you know, looking back a couple of years later, people going, oh yeah, you're really funny. Like, oh, okay. didn't think I was when I tried out for it. But I think, like you were saying earlier, I think everyone's got that in them. Mm. And it's just the sort of actually being able to admit that you do have that in you. And even though you don't think you're a funny person, everyone's a funny person, everyone's capable of laughing. So clearly you know what makes you laugh and you're able to let that out. And
actually we don't, like we never set up, like when we create a show, because it's not scripted, we never set out to do funny bits genuinely. And this is absolutely true. It could go one of either ways. It might be very serious, but it just never is because we just find human connection and there's always something funny in 2 humans connecting. And I think because we play it so big and so real, it just is funny. I don't know.
Yeah, life is funny, honestly. Yeah. Even tragedy is funny.
Yes.
Mm. We've had some pretty dark storylines that we've had to just understand that it's not one of the ones to go for jokes. And it's still always funny, but it's a different kind of comedy. Mm. And it comes from the tragedy of the situation. And I'm somebody who thinks you should be able to laugh at everything and anything as long as it's done respectfully.
Mm.
I think that's where a lot of comics, in my opinion, get it wrong. It always becomes punching down.
Yeah.
But I think you can laugh about anything. And I think once you've got, basically, improv only thrives in a safe space. And once you've got safe space and a respectful space, anything's up for grabs.
Yeah.
So I think that even in the most tragic stuff we did, we need to talk about Kevin. We did one which basically we need to talk about Kevin was one of my most stressful ones because I was Kevin. We also did one set in Auschwitz and we were like, how are we going to do this? And the answer was always find the truth and the honesty.
Mm.
And of the dynamic between those characters. It's not about plot. And actually, I always say as a director, our best shows are ones where there really isn't anything other than sets of people coming together and it's the emotional connection. And actually, if you trust that, as the show progresses, things will happen. And never forget that just watching two people interacting is so beautifully interesting to watch. The second you layer it with other nonsense, actually you lose the heart of what a musical is about, which is about heightened emotion and personal connection.
I think there's a really nice crossover with our world, which is all about helping businesses and leaders to communicate. And, you know, one of the buzzwords in our industry is always about being authentic.
Yeah.
And often in the process of trying to be authentic, you know, some people sort of become so rehearsed and prepared that they lose any of that authenticity. And actually the way you are authentic is like to be sort of more in the moment, improvise, you know, speak from the heart, shoot from the hip, cliches or whatever.
That entirely fits with how we've structured the show. And actually, we were novice improvisers when we put this together. I'd never directed an improvised show, but I knew I had something bubbling away that I wanted to create.
Yeah.
And when I auditioned the cast, I didn't want people who'd ever improvised before. I wanted singers who were funny or thought they were funny, or actors who were prepared to give it a go, who sang a little bit. So we were never coming from a place where we thought we were experts. The entire journey has been discovery for us.
Yeah.
And we've had to be authentic. And we've grown as a team, what works, what doesn't work, move forwards. And we've always had to really be an ensemble in terms of our thinking.
We weren't an all-female musical.
No,
we had men as well.
What happened to them? They get killed off.
Well, too much estrogen, to be honest. It just became what was right for this show. It wasn't, sorry guys, I'm not saying that men aren't as good improvisers, but it was literally what was authentic to Notflix.
Yeah.
There came a point where it became apparent that the new improvisers that were coming on were all women. And I think it just became organic. And then the two guys who we still love dearly and are super talented kind of decided it was time to step away. And
I think they organically felt that's the direction it was going. We love them. But in fact, you just wrote an article for the British Comedy Guide, didn't you,
about
working together with an all-female group.
Mm, it is definitely a different vibe.
Yeah.
And actually, I think a lot of it, not even just to do with how it is in the rehearsal room, but how it is on stage when you're an all-female group, I think you get a lot more freedom, weirdly, because you are all women. And I guess it does say a lot about audience expectations of gender, doesn't it? That you expect that there are going to be male characters in any story. So when the cast is all female, the audience just automatically go, obviously some of them are going to be men. And so you then go, oh, great, we can play whatever we want. Whereas actually, when we did have men in the group, I remember show where we stepped up in a scene and it was very sort of clear from the dynamic that we'd built together that both of us were guys. It was me and a male player and we both kind of agreed that that was it. And then he gave me a male name, being sort of very honest to that dynamic we'd built. And the audience all started laughing and we were both kind of like, oh, we didn't do that as a joke. That was just what the character was. And whereas when you're all women, that's not, it's just a different set of assumptions to
begin
with.
As performers, how lovely to have that choice that we're not, because It still happens. Comedy is changing, it certainly is, but it is still very much a male-dominated world. And certainly in the world of improv, which is highly, heavily male-dominated, we would, if we joined a team where, even if it was half and half, we would be wives, girlfriends, mothers. That's just, that's the semiotic meaning that would be imposed on us. That is what would happen.
So do you think in light, you know, the imbalance between men and women in your industry is reflected in life in general in terms of the skills and things you need?
Yes.
To do this. Go on.
Just the most emphatic answer. 100%. It's just the systems that are in place are there to promote men and make it harder for women. And that's not always deliberate. That's not to say there aren't good people not realising the systems in place. Some of them are deliberate, some of them aren't. But it's definitely, at every point, it's all about gatekeeping, isn't it? And we'd all be lying if it wasn't partly who we know and how we know them. And so if you've grown up surrounded by all men, so I'm a drummer. So up until recently, when I was training, all the people that I would get to debt for me if I couldn't go to a gig would be men, because there were like three women in my entire year and 100 men. And that's not me being sexist deliberately. That's me being part of a society that is. And then I had to seek out. So now it's the opposite, because it's just the way that my life has gotten. But I think it's just everything is reflected in everything. Yeah. Whether that's the entertainment industry, the business industry, it's just like, it's all one story, but we all have our own little kind of parts to play in it.
So taking away the kind of the bigger picture and the overall system for a minute and focusing maybe on sort of more of a one-to-one level with other women, what would your advice be to people who don't feel like the confidence to go out there and you know, go by the seat of their pants and improvise like the way you do, whether that's in the world of work, business, theatre, whatever?
I mean, I think actually going back to one of the things we were saying earlier, the biggest thing that I've learned from this is the self-censorship thing. And I think, typically speaking, women do that more than men do. And I certainly did before I got into improv. I would always be worried about, what do people think about me and how are people going to judge that thing I've just said? Oh, it's safer to just not say it because I don't want to sound like an idiot. And actually, I think that is the big thing that women everywhere can take forward is sort of to stop apologising for who you are and for what your thoughts are, and just say the stupid suggestion. And it probably isn't stupid, but even if it is, it doesn't matter. It's gonna help the fact that you've said it.
I've worked with lots of women and lots of men.
Well done, sir.
I've got five sisters, no brothers.
Nice.
I've worked with a very female dominated management team, but I can definitely say that men are definitely less reserved in presenting stupid ideas and in presenting them with lots of conviction and confidence. Yeah. You know,
that's not a bad thing.
No, it's not a bad thing. But I think you're right. It's about leveling that up.
It's
fascinating.
It is, isn't
working
it?
Working with some really, really clever, smart people. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in many cases, cleverer than some of their male peers, but actually being more reserved and cautious about what they say.
There's a thing that the women in the Obama White House used to do. I don't know if you've heard about it, because there's a thing that somebody, a lot of the time, women will say something and it won't be heard in the room. And then about 15 minutes will go by and then a man will have that idea and everybody will applaud it. And he's probably not doing it deliberately, but that happens. So what the women in the Obama White House used to do was somebody would say something, and if it got spoken over or just wasn't heard, even accidentally, they would all make a point to be like, oh, I really think that was really interesting what Eilish said about this. And if somebody tried to move on, then another person would be like, yeah, but going back to this, or if somebody tried to take that idea, they would then go, oh, yes, so when Eilish said that 15 minutes ago, and this is like Barack Obama, like
an ally, I guess.
Being very deliberate in recognising that. Yeah.
And that's not anti-men or trying to take up space that isn't yours. It's kind of trying to elevate other voices, not shout over other
and
people.
And we certainly do that in our show. I mean, we've just finished a show at the Southwark Playhouse on Sunday, and our entire team, from management through to cast to band, everybody in that theatre, in that experience, was female. Mm. Just because we've encountered so many brilliant female professionals. And actually, we don't believe in tokenism in our show. We're females at the top of our game. Yeah. And we want to work with other females at the top of their game. And so actually Sunday's show was a real celebration. Mm. Like, that was probably one of the only all-female bands on the West End stage that day, I imagine.
So if you sort of like fast forward into the future, and let's say you have a more equal representation in the arts of, you know, different, you know, people playing, you know, roles and so on. Do you think that as an audience we will just not notice it? Or do you think as an audience do you think audiences gravitate towards, you know, like, do guys gravitate towards like seeing the leading role being played by a guy, or do women gravitate towards seeing, because I went to see Incredibles 2.
Nice.
We've done it many times.
With my three kids.
Oh, nice.
A daughter and two boys. And my oldest boy, is 11, sort of came out and I said, oh, that was a really good film, wasn't it? And he said, yeah, it was good, Daddy. But, you know, my favourite character, you know, went from being the lead character, Mr. Incredible, to being like the house husband, you know, and like he was disappointed by that, you know. So I'm sure that my daughter probably came out of that thinking, hey, you know, like Mrs. Elastic, I think, or what, Elastica, or whatever, Elastigirl was the lead character. So, you know, like, is it like a zero sum thing where one person's going to be unhappy and someone's going to be happy, or how does that all play out?
I think young boys in general grow up entitled to think that their character will be the lead.
Yeah.
So when it doesn't happen, it's like, whoa, that's weird. Whereas young girls are growing up to believe that the male character will be the lead. And so when they see a female character be the lead, it is mind-blowing to them and amazing. But it also reminds them that they can do it. What we need is to not have the boys only liking the boy characters.
Yeah.
And I think that will change. And so what we need is more films doing what The Incredibles are doing. And then your daughter and your son will start to go, oh, everybody can be everything.
Yes,
But it's that in-between time where unfortunately your son has lost his
in a way that I feel like girls already do that. Like, I feel like when I was growing up, say, just because the first example I can think of, like Harry Potter,
yeah,
I didn't even question the fact that I massively associated with him and related to that character. It didn't cross my mind that I was a girl and he was a boy. Whereas I think because we do see so many more male protagonists, boys maybe notice that more because they're so used to being the norm.
So hopefully in future we'll all develop like more of a gender neutral lens that we'll look at things through.
Yeah. Yeah, I recently had a discussion with somebody who said to me, as if I'd never heard these statistics before, that men only kind of see themselves in other men and women see themselves in men and women, as if it was the big trump card to say that men are more relatable. And I was like, yes, because that's the way our society tells us to behave. And he was like, what? Because I think we think as humans that we are so innate, everything is innate, that what we are now is what we have always been and always will be. And we don't realise that we're all completely a product of the system that we're born into and the experiences that we have. Like, I personally think nurture way more than nature. So I think with the things that are going on at the moment, the deliberate choices to put females front and centre more, and to show men not always having to be bulky and never admitting that they have feelings. Patriarchy hurts the men too. It's nice. It's going to be so exciting over the next 10 years if it still keeps happening. And a lot of men can be like, oh, I really want to be like Moana when I'm older. Boys,
why not?
All men.
Yeah,
if you want to be Moana, you can be Moana.
Yeah. That's really good. And so obviously you guys have, you know, Sarah, in the team here, you know, you've created something from scratch.
Yeah.
How in that sort of journey, how has that been, you know, and how have you motivated yourself? And like, did you have a vision and then this is how you expected it to turn out? Or, you know, did it start as something different?
It's really interesting because I had one of those moments that people probably go through where I hit 30 and I thought, it's now or never. I was teaching in a public school and I thought, I can't do this anymore because I knew something was bubbling away. I didn't know what Notflix was, but actually we hit that title very early on. So I knew there was a show in me. And so actually it was relentless tenacity more than anything else. And I don't know whether this says something about my character, but I just never thought I would fail at this. It didn't even cross my mind. And at the beginning, I just thought, well, let's logically work our way through this. I have this idea.
Yeah.
I need to find a cast that works. So I audition the cast. On to the next. Now we book a venue, we do the show, we learn from a mistake. Yeah. I always, and even to this day, I always just think 6 months ahead. I have an end point, which is that we will be the most successful internationally and nationally improvised show. The female thing doesn't even come into it, but that's what we will be. And these are the logical steps that I will take to get us there. I've also, as a person, I never take no for an answer.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean if you say no to me, I'll badger you until you do. But if you say no, that avenue's closed. Now I'll forge another path. And actually with Notflix, at the beginning, doors were closed to us. They absolutely were because, you know, 3 years is a long time in terms of people's changing attitudes to women being funny.
Yeah.
When we started, I couldn't get us a gig.
Right.
I just couldn't because everything on paper that I was trying to pitch was against us. We were a musical group consisting of 6 women. No, I can't give you an example of the set because it's all made up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, I need enough room to put a live band on stage. There were no comedy clubs in the country that even with the best will in the world would have accommodated us. So yes, and it. I said, right, okay, that's done. I'll set up my own night. And we did. And actually what I discovered really early on was that there was such demand, almost from an alternative audience. And we were getting audiences that were solely consisting of women through the doors who wouldn't have dared go into a comedy club because they'd have been the target.
Yeah.
Or the humour would have been punching down to them. And we were creating a space where 6 women were on stage, creating something that felt organic and developed and interesting and about relationships. And from day one, we were selling out the room. There hasn't been a show that we had done for the first year that didn't sell out. Mm. And so straight away, money started coming in. But I guess the learning point for me was that's the zeitgeist. That's what people want. So I'm not wrong about this.
Mm.
And that's what fired me through.
Yeah.
And you always had such confidence in the idea as well. So it was that thing of sort of, as you said, always seeing this is where we want to go. And at the same time, like not, you know, when things did go wrong and doors did close, learning from that and saying, actually, no, we're going to go another way around.
Yeah.
So kind of, I guess, like that improv mindset really of sort of learning from the mistakes and using that as accepting that that's part of our journey.
But I never occurred to me that it would be impossible.
Yeah.
Because if other people could do it, and even if they hadn't done it, someone was going to do it. So why should that not be me? Because I knew I had the idea. I knew I had a cast that were world class. I just needed people to see them. And 3 years down the line, we haven't flatlined. We haven't gone backwards. We're moving forwards at a pace. And so, I've got a million things in the pipeline.
You've got to have that ability, but you've got to, more than anything, you have to have that belief.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why.
Total self-belief. It's never, ever occurred to me that we won't do this.
And is that something that was you from the word go? You've always been like that? Or was it because of the idea you came up with that you had just had such strong belief in it?
I think as a person, I've always been like this. If I decide to do something, I'll be the best at doing it. I decided.
You guys have no idea.
Honestly, I decided I wanted. This is before I set up Notflix. I was so bored with my teaching career. Decided I wanted to get onto the British Bake Off. I'd never cooked a cake in my life. I spent 6 months. I learned every recipe in Mary Berry's cookbook.
Brilliant.
Applied. Thought, they'll never let me through. I got a child to do my application form, told them what to say. When they phoned me up to do the phone interview, I'd internalised all the cooking times for... And I got down to the final 14.
Really?
And then I didn't get picked, so they only take 12.
But still,
I wanted to be the best at baking. Mm. And I wanted to be on that show. And that's what I was going to do. The second I got there, I was like, on to the next. I've done that. I've achieved that. So now something else.
You know, really good at baking.
So. I think that we probably all encounter people that have the sort of the starting point of an idea, or they've got a dream about maybe a job they want to do, but for whatever reason, they don't have that tenacity and that drive to make it happen.
Is that something you see in the businesses you work with as well?
I see a lot of businesses that are flatlined, to be honest. And as somebody, I think, who's always had, I don't know whether it comes from sort of having a massive working class chip on my shoulder and working in public schools and seeing the opportunities that I was never afforded.
Yeah.
It just makes me want to
grab
them.
Grab stuff, yeah.
I was the first person in my family to go to university. And so to see another world, that actually I got to university and I realised I didn't have access to any of the things that these people had. I couldn't afford to live there. I'm over 40, so I had a full grant to go to university because we couldn't afford for me to be there. So the second my eyes were open to a world that was bigger than I thought it was, I just wanted to grab every single bit. And actually, I think that is the most frustrating thing, seeing people who actually are in a position where they're working for companies where the ideas that you could put forward, that you could pitch, could be groundbreaking. From the perspective of the company you work for, they could be million-pound ideas, but actually, why are you happy stagnating? Why are you happy letting other people do things better than you? Actually, just having that mindset of, do you know what? If we're going to do this every single day, we could do this better than anybody else. Mm-hmm. I think that's why improvisation appeals. It's having some control over how things go in a positive, empowered way. You don't have to sit in this kind of ether of mediocrity. God, you could make things amazing.
So in practical terms, because actually I think you it'd be great to maybe have you guys
levels are going up and up and up.
Sounds exactly the sort of thing that we would love to do. In practical terms, what does it involve, in terms of if a company picked up the phone and spoke to you about wanting to do some training or something, how would that work?
So what I would say to you is that most corporations really struggle to innovate. They absolutely do. And it's exactly as we've said, people are happy sitting on that flat line. We're good at what we do. We're making money. We're not breaking new ground, but we're safe. We're happy with that. That's the problem. It's a problem for your bosses who are not getting any added value whatsoever. So what we do, the three aims, I guess, we train your team to communicate more effectively. And we've got ways of doing that, which I won't tell you because you won't book me. But we train your team to communicate more effectively. We coach you through this fear of failure because actually that is the biggest stumbling block. So we coach you to have this improvisational mindset. And we use this magic phrase, yes, and. What would happen if we just said yes instead of saying no? And within that, it's about understanding that every idea is just a platform to a better idea.
Yeah.
And we celebrate that idea. And then once we've got that instilled, we teach you how to generate more creative ideas. Yeah. And so we do that through core workshops, the Yes And workshop, a workshop which is probably pretty horrible, but it's fundamental elimination of fear, and then active listening. What is it to listen to the final words that somebody said? Because actually, if you can get a team working cooperatively, your work is done because everybody feels like they can share in a productive environment where things are celebrated. So actually, the skills that we teach this through, and I don't want to give anything away, are the techniques that we teach one another as improvisers.
Yeah.
And so it's a practical workshop. You don't sit down and do any reading. We get up, we dissect. And at the end, because we always, our shows, our tagline is everything is better as a musical. God, if life were as empowered as a musical, and that's what you will come out feeling at the end, actually the possibilities are open to you. If we can get on stage and improvise for an hour, you can get into a meeting and you can say your bit.
And also, I feel like there are so many levels to it. So we were talking earlier about how women can support each other and stuff. And we always put the onus on the people not being heard to be heard. But when you're teaching active listening and yes anding, you're also putting the onus on the person who's listening to it to hear. So you all of a sudden have a much safer space where, because you know you're going to be listened to and respected, you know that you're in a safe space to put forward your ideas. And because you know that you're going to hear everything, and that's part of what the yes and an active listening that we teach is, you know that anything they're giving you is valid, even if it's not something you would normally have listened to. So it kind of takes it from both sides of the spectrum.
Yeah, definitely. The active listening is just so useful in every part of life, I think. Because, I mean, we've probably all been there at some point in our life, sitting in a meeting where you actually realise, I haven't listened to a single word anyone else has just said, because I'm just trying to figure out the best way of wording this thing that I want to say.
Prepared.
And then you go, oh, hang on, I actually didn't hear what these people say. And then there's the kind of, let's put a little sentence in to try and make that relevant before I just slam my own idea in. And actually, it's so, you kind of think, well, what's the point of even being a team in that case? Yeah. Why don't companies just say, okay, we're never going to communicate with each other. You're doing this, you're doing this, you're doing this. But actually, the whole point of being a team is because, you know, 10 heads are better than one. You're always going to come up with better stuff when there are more people in the mix.
Yeah,
but that requires listening. Otherwise, there's no point in the 10 people even trying to speak to each other.
Yeah, one of us doesn't know as much as all of us. No. And that's what we celebrate on stage.
That's
so
less scary as well,
right?
Like, when you don't feel like, whenever I walk on stage, I'm like, I literally have no idea what's going to happen.
But you know we've got your back.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you've just got to commit. You've just got to say something, and then we're with you. The most dangerous words in a meeting are yes, but.
The devil's advocate.
Yeah.
It's funny. On a couple of notes, so from a creative process standpoint, when we come up with ideas, we sort of identify what the brief is and give everyone, put a team of people together on a project, and then we send them away for a couple of days and say, right, go away and think about this. And then everyone comes back and presents their idea on a piece of paper. So in that way, there isn't maybe some of the constraints that come with a brainstorm where, you know, like the person with the biggest mouth talks and so on. So everyone gets their moment. That's one thing. And then I thought this point about yes is an interesting one, because I had positions of responsibility at quite an early age, and because I thought I was quite smart, and I thought that was part of the reason why I was in charge, was because I was quite smart, you would naturally sort of interrogate every idea to the nth degree, you know, and so you end up with loads of time being spent interrogating an idea, questioning it, and by the end of it, everyone's a bit exhausted because, you know, you've interrogated something to the death. And I realised that if I continued to do that, I would probably piss a lot of people off. not a lot would happen.
Yeah.
And so my way of dealing with that was I would sort of say, okay, what's the worst that can happen? You know, so then I would basically say yes to everything.
Yeah.
Unless I thought, you know, something really bad was going to happen.
But that's just it. You don't have to act on every idea, but you have to give every idea the chance to be acted upon.
Yeah.
So,
and then you rely, then it's down to those people to make that happen.
Yeah.
You know, if they believe in it, it's not going to blow up the company. And, you know, and then you give them the platform to make it work. And that some people will seize that, other people won't. But, you know, that's sort of part of the opportunity.
Just try it for a day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Seeing every idea as a valid jumping off point and sort of going, okay, well, if we do take this idea, where would we take it?
Yeah.
Which also, so it's that thing in improv where, I remember you describing in a rehearsal once that an improvised show is like, it's like you're walking backwards through it and you only at the end go, oh, that's what the show was.
Yeah.
And so actually, if someone throws down an idea and it's been totally different to what's been in my head, but you go, okay, I can't now go back and say, no, we're not in a cinema, we're in space or something, because that's been established, that's now a fact. You have to just go, okay, this is where we are, what can I do next? And you have to shelve your own idea because it isn't compatible with what someone else has
put
down.
But it's also totally liberating to step on stage, and genuinely, I say this all the time, you have to have nothing prepared. Mm. Step on and listen and react and we'll find it. And that's where the magic is. And it's terrifying. But we do that in front of 500 people.
Yeah.
So it's never going to be as terrifying for you as it is for us.
And it is such a good way of, yeah, just in every part of life, treating other people's ideas with that level of respect, of just going up and saying, okay, this doesn't match with mine. So actually, let's roll with yours. Let's say yes to yours. And instead of me sitting here negative going, my idea would have been better than this, actually thinking, okay, but where can we take this one that's on the table now?
Yeah.
Is just so much more useful.
Do you find that, do you have like an on-off button in the sense that when you step on stage, you're like, I'm in improv mode, or, and then you sort of come off and you become a different person, or you like...
I find it really hard to turn it off.
I think I used to, and I feel like now it's just merged with my personality.
Yeah. We teach something called the heat and wait. So this is how we genuinely have nothing in our brains when we step up. So say Mad Max is the movie. We think about by weight, what's the elephant in the room? What does this film suggest? We don't make any choices to do with characters. And by the heat, what's the friction? How hot is this atmosphere? Just influenced by the title of that movie. So all we step forwards with is that. And then that's the platform that we build on. So actually, it's hard to detach yourself because Holly's always going to step forwards as Holly. There's going to be something. It's just basic actor training. There's always something of you in the character. Mm. But we try and eliminate that as best we can. So I think actually what you're seeing with Notflix now is really an extension of the six people.
And there's no point in trying not to be you as well. I can be me playing a man, a woman, a dinosaur from another realm, but I'm me playing a man or a woman and a dinosaur from another realm. If I'm playing Hamlet, that's a whole different thing, but I'm playing me playing this character. And so, particularly as it's improv, because we don't know what's coming next. So it's the same really in business when you're in a meeting. Being you, coming up with these ideas that are beyond you, and that makes you see things in other people that you didn't think. When somebody who you haven't really heard before comes up with a gem that you then leap on, not being the most important person in the room is actually really cool because it means that you don't feel guilty if something doesn't turn out perfectly. And it also means that you get to share the love when everything comes up roses.
And the biggest, one of the biggest lessons we learned is, if you just trust people have got your back, and it's okay to lean back and know that the team have got you, because actually sometimes continuing to push forwards blindly, suspecting that you're wrong, is more damaging than just saying, do you know what? I messed up here.
I can tell you right now, we've done hundreds of shows and there has never been a single show where somebody has stopped talking and had a difficult moment and then everybody else has just left the stage and left them to dry because it won't happen. The moment you just go, oh, well, actually, even if I stood there and did nothing, something would happen. So liberating, because something always happens.
Incredible. Unfortunately, we are drawing near to the end of our time. However, we do have one final question we just want to put to you, which we've been putting to all our guests, and it relates to the fact that we as a business like to work in a really agile way, and we are not constrained to the boundaries of a desk or even an office, and we can work wherever we want to be. So I'm just kind of wondering for you guys, what is your desert island desk? Where would you be based? What's your work setup? What do you need to be successful?
Can it be anywhere?
Anywhere.
In the world.
Mine is a bit weird.
In the universe.
I'm a bit obsessed with Tokyo. I've been a couple of times. It really appeals to me. I could live in Tokyo. But there's Shibuya Station. There's that crossing where, honestly, every time the crossing changes, 2,500 people, that's not even an exaggeration, I know I'm prone to exaggeration, cross from different directions. Oh, and there's, I remember sitting in the Starbucks, which looks right over that, and watching thousands of people, thousands and thousands, meeting and crossing and passing. And that controlled chaos really appeals to me. I think I'd base myself there. I'd just watch people interact all day.
You'd be flattened, but it would be amazing.
I'd be in the Starbucks.
Yeah, nice.
No, that's not possible.
Oh, that's a good answer. I feel like mine, I don't know whether this would actually be allowed in the context of a desert island desk, but I would choose to just have my desk somewhere different every day. Like, I wouldn't really necessarily mind what it is, as long as like no 2 days are the same. Because I think, yeah, no matter what amazing setting I was in, if I was looking at the same thing every day, I feel like my ideas kind of stagnate a bit. And it's, yeah, kind of like we were saying about the improv thing, it's bouncing off other people's offers. So if I had kind of different setting offers to bounce off each day. I think that would work best for me.
How about you, Holly?
So originally I was thinking something like, you know, I was saying about like how I think it's Google or YouTube have the wicked offices where you can go and just play the drums for a while. And then I was like, but sort of my office is a lot of the time behind a drum kit and stuff. So I'm thinking if I'm writing, which is probably my main actual desk job, to be honest, a really boring office space with maybe a window that looks up quite high, looks out onto the city with two screens and the kind of inability to be distracted by going off, probably with an intranet instead of an internet.
You're a massive conformist.
Well, it's because my whole life is, I was thinking, God, theatres would be amazing. My whole life is theatres and lots of festivals. You know, I've played Glastonbury. That would be a hellish place to have an office. So actually, just a really boring, really nice, neat office with two screens and nothing to do but sit and write the play that I've been trying to write for 4 years and finally has it showing on Monday would be great.
And I think what's great about your three stories there is that each of you needs something different for your inspiration. And I think it just shows you how, you know, the traditional office has such severe limitations in terms of inspiring people, because it might work for 1 in 3 people, but it might, you know, or, you know, 1 in 10, but it certainly doesn't work for everyone.
Well, the traditional office suddenly becomes really exciting when you never go in a traditional office. I have this like secret fantasy where I just want to put on like a pencil skirt and a nice white blouse and some respectable heels and walk into an office and just be a corporate person for a day.
I'm sure that can be arranged.
I'm not bad at typing, because that's not your world. Yes. So I think that's kind of like, if there were just 6 Hollies in Netflix, it would be really boring. So it would just be me laughing at what I find funny. it pretty much already is us laughing at what
we find ourselves funny.
But so I find a kind of office cubicle really exciting. I'd be like, well, I can put
that's
my
exotic
pictures of dogs here. And
do you actually, sorry, I know we met at an end, but do you laugh at your own jokes?
All the time.
We laugh at each other. Yeah, I guess we do, don't we?
Because I always get told off for laughing at my own jokes, but
why tell a joke if you don't think it's funny?
You're never going to say something you don't think is funny.
Right, okay. Yeah. That's good.
Say it and then laugh.
Never let anything.
I think we've pretty much morphed into one entity that just finds each other pretty amusing.
Luckily, everybody else does.
People buy tickets, so good. We're all right.
You've just given Brendan the green light to tell us more awful jokes.
Oh, no.
We're so sorry.
Guys, come on. Right.
Brilliant.
Well, thank you so much. It's been fantastic hearing from you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Without Borders. If you like what you've heard, why not subscribe? And if you want to find out more about Tyto and what we're up to, you can find us at tytopr.com. That's TYTOPR.com.